This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical or legal advice. Always follow your local policies, procedures, and protocols when functioning in your respective profession. Additionally, the views expressed by the speakers and owners of this podcast are their own and do not represent the views of their respective employers. Listener discretion is advised.
Alert Medic 1, respond.
Ken, Josh, and Mustafa here. Welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast.
And we're recording, so Owen, you want to introduce yourself real quick?
Hey, I'm Owen Humphreys, and I'm a flight medic for a program that runs all over the Pacific Northwest.
Nice. How long have you been a flight paramedic?
I've been a flight medic for this company about 6 months, and I've had my FPC about 8 or 9 months total.
Before that,
I was working at a certain unnamed urban department with certain other members of this podcast for about 5 years.
Nice. Nice. How'd you get into EMS? Like, were you a volunteer before or just?
It was one of those things I always was interested in, growing up. I, like most people of our age group, adored watching stuff like ER, but just in high school, I didn't go for it. And then I ended up doing other, a different career for a while, got burnt out of that. And just let's try doing the EMS thing. And here I am 10 years later, talking to you guys on my day off.
You got into EMS after getting burned out from something else. That's interesting.
I cooked professionally for 8 years, and so I figured, I'm going to get yelled at by drunken assholes, already dropped a bomb, I might as well have insurance out of it.
Have you seen the show The Bear?
I have deliberately made a choice not to, just because everything everybody says just reminds me, I saw that in real life, and I don't need to do that again for free.
I was going
to
ask you how accurate it was, because everyone tells me it's, not I have friends that are chefs in high-end restaurants, mm-hmm. but the people that have been cooks and stuff before tell me it's pretty accurate. So I don't know.
No, the few people I know still in the industry, they say it's obviously it's still a show, but they're a bunch of the little things are disturbingly close.
Have you guys seen it? Anyone else on the show?
I think I watched an episode and a half.
It is so good. The entire first. Have you guys ever heard of the? It's a Switch game called Overcooked. You guys heard of that? Have you heard of it, Owen? It's
that's
a kitchen management
deep
game.
Pull.
Yeah,
that is a deep pull.
It causes anxiety to some people. I personally love it. And by people I mean my wife. And my wife does not like playing that game. And also, she said that the first season of The Bear is just anxiety inducing. I can certainly see why, but no, I just certainly a tangent.
What is it? Why is it so? Why do people freak out about it?
Owen?
Well, probably just because it's such a weird, high stress environment over things that don't actually matter in the end, and
EMS.
Yeah,
I was just about to say that.
And if it's the Switch game, it's a lot of teamwork, and one person lags behind and probably gets screamed at, and their life is probably threatened.
Man.
EMS.
The parallels are.
I mean, did you really change careers, Owen?
Yes, because now I have paid time off and insurance.
Fair.
I'd probably get paid a little bit more.
I work 6 days a month now, and I get twice what I ever did as a working in restaurant. So I'm okay with that.
Hey, winner, winner.
Right?
Yeah.
So tell us about the system you work in, man.
I work in a system that spans 30 flight bases over 4 different states, which if anyone – I wonder what this could be for people who are flight enthusiasts out there. We have run 4 different helicopter types – over across those regions, and we do a variety of scene calls and IFT, depending on which flight base you're out of. It depends on the ratio. Some of them run as much as 30 to 40% scene flights. Others just 10, 15. We also have 4 or 5 fixed wings that we will use for especially long distance transports, and if like the weather is bad, and we just do a little bit of everything here and there.
Have we ever worked fixed wing services in Maryland?
I don't think you do.
Well, Grandview does some fixed wing work. We're co-located with them.
Sorry, Ken, I cut you off, by the way. Sorry.
That's okay. I was just going to ask Owen if he's ever done any work with the fixed wing stuff, because that's always fascinated me, especially when you get into these really long, like, international transports and some of the stuff that goes on with that.
I've not done any of, like, the really long distance, like, transports. Some of our bases actually require you, if you're working there, to actually have your passport with you, because they could get pulled up to Canada. And I know we've done some, like, extremely long distance transports where they're going, I think, over the summer, I think somebody actually had to go all the way to Boston for a flight. But the longest, like, routine ones we'll do will be taking someone from, like, Portland or Boise to, like, Salt Lake City or San Francisco.
Wow.
I've taken people from Portland to Boise before, which is about an hour and a half flight.
Do you live in Oregon?
Yes, I live in Portland. If I actually was recording not on my headphones, you could actually hear one of our helicopters land at the airport. Not the airport. The hospital is just about a quarter mile away.
The reason I ask that is because I've been to Portland multiple times. One of my best friends is he went to medical school there, and now he's a first year neurosurgery resident there at OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University. Yep. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
So nice. No, that's cool. That's cool.
One of the two level one trauma centers in the Portland area.
And you said you guys fly four different aircraft types. I'm guessing the 135 and 145 is probably one or two of them.
We have the 135, we have the Bell 407, we have the Bell 429, and we are just finishing up, replacing all our Augusta Westland 119s with Bell 407s. To answer Ken's earlier thing about fixed wing, it is really like kind of like a hybrid between doing a ground ambo and a helicopter, because it's smaller than an ambo and you're still wearing like headsets and stuff, but you have a lot more room to move around in, and you still have like a lot more access to your all your gear. So it's kind of like a nice little median.
It's like being in a vanbulance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the scene transports you do. Mm-hmm. Some of the pictures you've sent me are absolutely phenomenal. The scenery you work in. But one of the stories you told me once was where you had a really sick patient. You did a scene transport, but then you had to land halfway to the hospital because of the weather, and you got grounded, and you ended up having to take like an hour and a half or plus ride to a hospital. Can you talk about kind of how stuff like that plays out?
Well, especially with the Pacific Northwest weather, especially along the places like the Columbia Gorge, or like if you're in Washington, the Stampede Pass, which is one of like the two ways to get through the Cascades up to Seattle, the weather can be shifty at best. So what we were talking about this one, we had picked up some person who was having it was actually interfacility. It was an end-STEMI heparin drip, nothing too serious, but the weather in the gorge just went from very nice to you can't really see very much really quickly. So we actually had to divert to one of our local bases along the gorge. And so we had to, when we're doing that, we had to give like dispatch a call, and they had to get one of the local fire departments to meet us at the airport with one of their transport units, whereas just some random firefighter EMT, and we transfer all the patient and all our gear out from the helicopter into a ground transport, and then transport them the like hour and 10 minutes all the rest of the way to Portland.
That's wild to me. Just hearing that kind of interface between air to ground, and then to imagine a transport time of an hour and 10 minutes. coming from the system that, you know, I worked in up until very recently, you know, where we might have a 10-minute transport time on a bad day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, it's fascinating to me. And I know that there are places out there where the ground transport times are much longer. But still, it's a very interesting peek into a different system from where I'm sitting.
We actually had two more examples. One, it was actually like, because the way flights, the FAA regulates flights, is pilots can only work like a certain amount of like hours mm-hmm. using a duty day. When us scrubs, they're like, we don't care. You're there till you can't be there anymore, until you pass out. But if pilot's day is limited at 14 hours. And so we got a call coming in for like a STEMI transport coming in, having to go from like a rural facility to like one of the major facilities. That was one of the rural facility was on the way back to our base. And so they end up actually dropping us off to me and my nurse to go ahead and start packaging the patient while the pilot goes to the flight base, which is about a 5-minute flight away, to swap over. We get a call about 10 minutes or so after there, and they're like, yeah, in the 10 minutes since we dropped you off, the weather has gotten so bad, we are now going to have to dispatch you a fixed wing. So then dispatch now has to coordinate getting a fixed wing to that closest airport, and has to coordinate getting like one of the local transport services. I think we ended up going, having AMR actually pick us up to take us to the airport, where then we actually had to crew that fixed wing to take them the rest of the way to the specialized facility.
What kind
of insert AMR joke here?
Right. I was waiting for someone to say something like that.
I'll give AMR credit. They're actually like, without being like being too disparaging of them on the East Coast, they're like, they have really feel like they have their stuff a lot together more out here. Maybe just because of the way the environment is, they almost have to be, just because like they are rural metro are the primary 911 like transport contract for a lot of the major cities around here. And a lot of like the rural cities especially.
So oddly enough, my first flight job was a fixed wing job for AMR there. And now I can totally sympathize with you, man, of duty time issues. I remember one day it was an 8-hour mission, and it almost, the pilots were like, hey, if we don't leave now, you guys are driving back from Dallas. We'll hurry up.
Oh, that happened to my friend a couple months ago, where they ended up timing out in Boise and had to drive back like 3.5 hours to base. And the crew that was taking over actually met them halfway. So they're exchanging all their equipment and narcs and doing like a changeover, for all intents and purposes, a changeover at some truck stop off of I-84.
Wow.
You know, it makes you wonder what the possibilities would be if we had a strong federal agency that could regulate our work conditions.
I know one of the things that I really, really appreciate about like my flight program is we put a ton of emphasis on like safety. Like they like beat into like our head from like day one, just like the whole like it takes 3 to go and 1 to know situation. And so like if at any point anybody feels comfortable, they can turn down a flight, and they'll like try it. And it could be if it's like weather or like fatigue or something, then they'll try to figure out a way to like make it work. But they are very much we do not want to have like an incident that results in like a crash or like an incident.
And I don't want my friendly small government fan Ken here to punch me through the screen. So to be clear, I'm not advocating for a. I don't know. That's something I'd have to think about. But I'm not advocating for a strong federal thumb to limit what shifts people can and can't work. But it's just an interesting thought.
I mean, Moose, it's almost like there already is an agency that regulates this. But the fact that Owen is more than likely, I'm guessing, looked at as a non-rated crew member by the FAA, then the FAA doesn't care how long he works. they only care how long the pilot works. So maybe it's more of, let's, you know, we don't even have to go the EMS route on this. Should rated or should non-rated crew members have a max amount of hours that they can work? Comparative.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, go through like the aviation route. Yeah, yeah. No, I was just speaking more broadly, but yeah, no, that's interesting.
I believe there are agencies that do this, by the way, and they work state. They are not private. I'm not saying exactly who they are, but I'm pretty sure they have a cap on their crew member hours.
So this is where the organization CAMES.
CAMES enters big into this one.
So yeah. CAMES prefers and likes 12-hour shifts for the clinicians, for the non-rated crew. They like 12-hour shifts, and that's kind of where they like to live. But they also realize that most organizations could never attract enough workforce for 12-hour shifts and make them 12-hour shift money. So they allow for 24s as long as at any point, as long as the organization that they're accrediting has a policy in place that at any point during the day, the on-duty crew can call crew rest and take as many rest breaks as they need to. And they are also, technically, I don't want to say the word duty timeout, but those crews time out at 16 hours of continuous patient care. Yeah. And then that crew they're done for the day. So
yeah, CAMES is kind of like the gold standard for flight programs especially, but really any kind of like non-911 transporting company. Like they are they really literally set the standard for that sort of things, and I could never remember what CAME stands for, but they are like hyper specific. And I know people on like East Coast who do the 12 hours, like they'll do like a 12 hour like day shift at like 2 days in a row, and if they get held over, CAME's requirement says you have to have 10 hours of uninterrupted like rest between your shifts. Mm-hmm. So that will actually push back their shift the next day if they get held over.
Wow. That's so, really cool.
In reference to this whole culture of safety thing we're talking about, we've talked about aviation a little bit. How do we feel about ground transport? You know, coming from a busy urban system, what can be done to create a better culture of safety on the ground where a lot of us work?
I mean, I think a lot of it just has to do with, I'm going to try to not limit this. I'm going to try to not pull a can with big government by having a long rant about healthcare as a business. So I think a lot of it comes down to like making the best decision for a patient and the crew. And so like if trying to run a crew into the ground because you want to get them from hospital to hospital and just get all those calls done, that definitely makes it worse for a patient care perspective, because it leads to errors like all the way through. As again, like my flight program like is big on what they call on the whole Swiss cheese thing, on how it's never just one error, one like decision that results in like a significant error. It's a series that kind of line up.
So it's not by happenstance, right? That those holes line up. There is usually a normalization of deviance that they find in there. And it's usually from a lack of accountability from the leadership.
So
we let the little things slide until it becomes a catastrophe.
Yeah. So like as we're talking about this, you know, like we talk about CAMES, and Ken, you're asking like how do we institute this this safety environment and this that safety is pervasive in what we do, and try and get crews rest in the ground 911 world. I think it's the approach of like, hey, do we get these crews rest? And like, we're like, okay, you're off the roster, quote unquote, or you're off the board for an hour or 2 hours. You can't take any calls. You're not in service. Take a nap, get some food. Don't worry about running calls. I don't know if that is completely achievable in our current systems that we have. We have enough issues that are being raised about staffing, call volumes going up, hindrances on the system of, okay, well, you just held the wall at a hospital for an hour. Isn't that rest? Because, you know, there's an admin that's going to say that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like you know, okay, well, you weren't running a call, but you waited for a bed for X amount of time. That counts as your rest period. So you're going to get around this. So I think some of it might play into, do we place other things in there that help us. So unfortunately you weren't able to be there with us with Amy, but she talked about the nurse triage line that DC uses. And since it was instituted until she left in February of this year, they diverted 20 to 30,000 patients. So what does that look like for the crews on the street not having to run those calls? It might get them a bit more time where they could actually rest between calls. Or, you know, once again, hearkening to DCFD, using AMR for the BLS calls, which then frees up the ALS units that are staffed by a DCFD, or insert whatever metro department decides to do this, to handle the ALS calls, which I think most of us would agree would reduce the call volume and the stress that the 911 ground crews feel on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
I feel as though a lot of ALS providers would be like, if you could take the BLS calls that are dispatched BLS off my plate, life would get a lot better.
Okay. I think people would think that, but if you replace volume with acuity, you're not managing fatigue any better than you were before.
Very right?
Because we all, because you're just trading, I'm going to trade these 10, I don't want to say nonsense. It's not nonsense, but I'm going to trade these 10 less acute calls, and I'm going to pick, and I'm only going to do these 8 big deal calls. The fatigue meter still goes doink the other direction. Oh,
100%. Like I would like, if I have like 4 flights where I'm just like, I'm staring at a heparin drip and that's it. Like that's okay. That's not going to fatigue me as much as 1 or 2 where I'm managing like 5 pumps. They're on a vent. I'm like transporting an Impella where like and especially then when you count like all the charting that has to come with a high level acuity call. Triggered Cody on that one, as I thought I would. But there's like definitely a golden zone between call volume and like the acuity of the call. Just like I know in 911 as now, I will happily be like, especially if I'm getting ran, I'll be like, oh yes, I will absolutely take this borderline levo drip or a heparin drip and nothing else, and just I'm gonna try to relax as much as I can and not get worn down on this relatively low level acuity.
Yeah. There's all kinds of fatigue assessments out there that actually take this kind of stuff into account. I'm going to link one in our chat that comes from the air medical community. Where's the chat? There's not a chat.
It's down at the bottom right.
There it is. I found it. There it is. I'm just an idiot.
Is this our save score?
No, this is a different one. This one published 2019, from Air Medical Journal, it looks at how much sleep did you have in the last 24 hours? How well did you sleep in the last 24 hours? How much sleep did you have in the last 72 hours? And then you kind of get a box to go, you know, how are you feeling right now? Or how's your personal stress right now? Yeah. You know, are you like getting it from the boss because you're a disciplinary problem, so your stress level's up? And then are you ill? And then there's a post-transport fatigue assessment that talks about a lot of that stuff too. My organization, a couple of other organizations use a fatigue assessment test thing called PVT testing. And it's like a little game you play on your phone right when you come on a shift to assess the fatigue level. And if you score a certain amount, it actually flags all the way back at the corporate office, and you start getting phone calls of, hey, are you actually fit for duty to be here? Now, is that possible in the FD and then on the ground side? You know, a piece of me wants to say yes.
I know my company has just rolled out because we're expanding our ground operations, and they've actually just rolled out a new like ground transport safety checklist. Mm-hmm. So like we use two different, we use the I am safe thing that the FAA uses, and then we use a different thing that assigns you points based on various things. Like if it's your first year in the company, you get like 2 points. If you have like if it's your first day on a new helicopter, like it's 2 points. If you're, it's like your first day with this new crew, that's 1 point. If you have like a 2 hour drive, that's 2 points, and so on. And so, if you're like sick, you get like 2 points, and you're supposed to add up all your points. And if you have more than 15, you're supposed to contact like the clinical administrator on call, which sometimes it's as simple as like, cause I just switched bases. Like my first day there was like 20 points. And so I call, I'm like, yeah, it's just my first day here. I don't know where anything is yet. They're like, okay, cool. That's fine. And then my next shift there, I was down to like 4, but it's just them like keeping track of like what is going on.
You know, that's really interesting. If you guys think back to a conversation we had with, I'm struggling to remember exactly who it was. It was a battalion chief out of somewhere. But the idea of tracking acute stress after SISM. Yeah, Chief Savak.
Yep.
The idea of being able to track this kind of stuff after, you know, heavy calls or bad days or stuff like that. Maybe there is a way to do it through some kind of an app or something like that, and we can assign.
Flight companies use something called Baldwin safety reports, where like if you have an issue, if there's like a mechanical issue, like when we had to like land due to the weather, the pilot had to fill out a Baldwin. Like if something breaks, we had to fill out like a Baldwin, or stuff like that. So that it will then go to like a committee and then get kicked up the chart, and it ranges from anything from like I twisted my ankle to the vent stopped working to we had to land due to inclement weather to, you know, something actually catastrophic, where and it actually will have you rate on a scale of like 1 to 4 like how like damaging like the thing is based on like patient safety or like how much like it would cost to fix. Like if you had to like land due to like something breaking, you'd be like, oh, that'd be like a Baldwin 3. Or if it's just like I rolled my ankle, that's a Baldwin 1.
You know, it's not out of the realm of possibilities what you're asking, Ken. You know, an app, or you know, talking about this I Am Safe or the PVT assessment that Cody brought up. Every morning when I go into work, by 11 o'clock, I have to log my NARCs on an electronic reporting system on my phone or my EPCR or computer in the station. Or I get a call from my duty officer saying, hey, you didn't log your NARCs.
Right.
So why would it not be possible for everyone on a shift, firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, officers, all of them, first thing in the morning before lineup, before shift starts? You know, it's a simple app or link that you can put on your phone, just like what I posted the other day about having it right there on the homepage. First thing you do in the morning when you get to work, you fill it out, submit it, and then it's on your officer to be like, hey, you didn't submit your pre-work stress assessment, whatever you want to call it. And then, you know, yes, there's ways to probably game it and people that are going to abuse it and try and figure out how to get out of work using it. But then, you know, maybe we institute things like, okay, well, you've had 3 shifts in a row where you've had a score of whatever. We want you to come off the floor and go talk to county mental health and be like, what's going on? Like, why are you coming to work exhausted, stressed, insert XYZ, whatever you're putting in your assessment. Let's see if we can't get some resources for you to try and, you know, is something actually going on? And if it is, let's get ahead of the 8 ball. And try and reduce provider stress, personnel stress, and other unfortunate circumstances that can come from that down the road that we unfortunately see all too often in first responders nowadays, which is self-harm and taking of lives.
So. You know, it's interesting you say that. Well, you guys are talking about this. I can't help but think about actually something from the infectious disease world. So there's actually a local company in Baltimore. It used to be called Emoca. I just looked it up. It's now called Scene Health. So the app that I'm talking about, what they did was if you worked in a biocontainment unit or if you were transporting a high consequence pathogen patient, this was an app that you checked in and it took your, you took your vital signs, but I believe it also took your temperature, or, you know, you measure your temperature and put it in there. I want to say there was some sort of facial something. Maybe I can't remember the exact details. But it was, at least part of it was for, like transport teams. So certainly the technological solutions are out there that would capture all the things you are describing. And at least to us here in Maryland, a lot more local than you would think. Certainly an interesting idea.
Some of the organizations that use this, they're trying to do some data collection along with it and validate the tools, which they've been validated, and then figure out what they're going to do from a process perspective. And part of the problem with an app type of thing, or even to your point, Josh, of saying, hey, everybody before lineup, you know, you've got to have this done. Compliance with the tool is a known issue. Or abuse of the tool is an issue. And some organizations actually have a graded response. So at this level of this many, at this score, you're going to get a phone call from an administrator or somebody like that to kind of figure out what's going on with you. At other scores, it actually mandates a NOC health visit.
Something like that, like I just coming from, you know, the urban department, my two like real concerns with that would be like one, like, because there's a lot of times where at my old job, I'm changing on the ramp. Where it's just like, okay, I do have these NARCs, okay, cool, and immediately running a call. And so something like that, which honestly is like not as important as like making sure I have my NARCs, making sure everything's worked, gets pushed down. And I'd be concerned about then some officer getting a hair in them and then using that as part of, you know, giving me blue papers for not filling that out, which then I would be worried about then someone just like, okay, I'm just going to pencil whip this. And so now they're not getting like... the care they might need because they're like, oh, well, you said you were fine 10 days in a row just because you just filled it out so you didn't get yelled at while you're in the process of running 15 calls in a 14-hour day.
Okay, not to nitpick, but Ken, you've been trying to say something. You go ahead.
No, it's okay. Go ahead, Josh.
Not to nitpick on like what the officer can do, but you'd have to build this as a non-punitive assessment. Like, it doesn't matter if you don't do it or not. There's no, you can't do any paperwork on someone. Like, you can only be like, hey, man, can you please fill this out? And just be that squeaky wheel officer that's just like, you fill out your stuff yet? Fill out your stuff yet? And I really need that filled out, you know? Because if you, like you said, if you make it punitive, people are just going to not do it, or they're going to pencil whip it. And they're just going to be like, give me the papers because I'm going to fight this with the union, or I'm going to fight this with the city, the county, the agency, whoever, because they're going to win. Honestly, but I get that too, though. Like, there's mornings, especially in the department that you came from, where once you get that handoff and you get those NARCs signed off and you're off on that next call, you know, one, you might be going for your next 12 hours with no stop. And maybe that first call in the morning was something that was high acuity and it just shoved everything else out of your mind and you forgot. It happens. We're humans. It's human nature. It's going to happen. But I don't know. There's got to be, you know, I never thought of this until we just talked about it now, but there's got to be something.
There's also the other end of the spectrum where you're going to have people who abuse it and who mark high stress ratings constantly until they hit the benchmark where they have to go off sick. And then they get to enjoy some time off.
I tend to believe that in that very narrow spectrum right there, that there are, if that's happening, that's a symptom. It's still a symptom of a problem.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there's always the 1% that you can't write the policy for that are absolutely going to abuse it to get out of work or to get out of doing the job. And for those folks, there has to be some kind of punitive action. I mean, I don't know if it's falsifying an organizational document or something like that, right? But I believe that the folks that are doing that actually don't have the stones to speak up and say something, are doing that because they need somebody to sit them down across the desk and go, yo, what is up with you? What is going on? Try to get to the root of the problem. Maybe not as aggressive as I just portrayed it, but that is still, in my opinion, that's a symptom of a bigger problem until proven otherwise.
I agree with Cody 100%. I think, like, if someone's going to want to be like abuse something like this, they're going to. We've all been places where someone's going to find any loophole they can, just be like, oh, going off again because of COVID or whatever. So they'll find stuff regardless of what's in place. And I think something like this is going to open up more like safety doors and mental health doors or whatever for the people who would use it correctly, just because, again, the people who are going to abuse it will just abuse no matter what is in place.
Now, if you're just like me and you're kind of person that's just trying to piss the boss off, all right, but you get what's coming to you, all right?
Yeah, so
I imagine that in a culture where this is executed appropriately, you're also going to have pressure from your peers not to mess it up. Right, I mean,
with the right team, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You're gonna have pressure not to be this, you know, the dirtbag, for lack of a better term.
I don't know. I've worked some places with some really good sick leave policies that got really abused, and no amount of pressure can shame some people.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Obviously. Certainly not multiple of my partners at that previous place that may or may not exist.
Ken, were you going to say something? I cut you off.
But... I was, and for the life of me, I cannot remember what it was. But, I mean, it goes into a broader discussion on mental health, which we love to talk about here. We're all big advocates of mental health. There has to be a way to, you know, I mean, I track my own mood on an app. And I find that very helpful to tell when something's wrong. I don't see why someone can't do the same thing with stress or burnout or, you know, things like that. How am I feeling at work? You know, just track that and say, okay, my mood is progressively low at work. Why is that? Maybe I do need to talk to somebody. Maybe there's a problem here.
And it works. Ken, and I think all of us know this, that, I mean, that kind of stuff, it works until you hit apathy, until you're straight up, you're just, fuck it, right?
Yep.
Just forget it, man, whatever. And that's where I think it comes back to the team, and it comes back to the officers and people going, people taking that control of that away from you and sitting down with you and going, yo, something's up, what's the problem? You know, yeah, we had a bad call a couple of weeks. Is it X, Y, or Z, you know, I tend to kind of, you know, I learned this as a young NCO, and it's one of four things generally that's got somebody down like that, right? Either it's your finances are screwed up, you're fighting with your spouse, you're fucking around, you shouldn't be, or the other one is you're fighting with your spouse because you got caught fucking around. You know what I mean? It is usually one of those four things. And I would say that's accurate 95% confidence interval. On that one. And so it's not always the job, but the job certainly does, especially with what we do, it certainly adds to the allostatic load. And what we're talking about is trying to measure that, which I don't know if, man, we could all retire if we figured out how do you measure individual allostatic load accurately and then have an intervention in place for that.
Yeah. You know, what I can't help but think about is our conversation with Garrett Steffen, who was a former sheriff's deputy. And he mentioned something about, at least on the law enforcement side, and this is a question for you guys. He mentioned on the law enforcement side a certain identity with the gun and the badge, and you losing that when you open up about your mental health. I wonder if there's any overlay here with EMS, and that there is a hit to one's identity if you do come out and ask for help. Again, it's a question. I don't know.
I don't
just
know.
From personal, go ahead.
Owen, you're the guest, please.
I know, just from personal experience, like I know, like when I was just doing like my like baby EMTB ride-alongs, I like heard people trying to talk about like mental health and like high acuity, like schism type stuff at like the fires, like house, like table, just when I was doing my ride alongs. And there was like a lot of pushback going, like, I remember they were talking about how somebody ran like a pediatric arrest, and half the people were going, that's terrible, do you want to talk about it? The other people are going, suck it up, this is the profession you chose. Cut to versus in 7 years later, me and everyone else on my shift is having brunch, and we are literally comparing our psychiatric medications and our therapy strategies.
Yeah, I'm with Owen on this one. I think that things have shifted dramatically. You know, I came out with that big thing about my long list of mental health issues about almost a year ago, and the support was overwhelming. You know, it was not in any way like, get out of EMS, you don't belong here. Maybe law enforcement's a very different animal. I've never been a law enforcement officer. But I don't think that's the case in EMS anymore. Maybe in some places, but I don't think where any of us work right now that are on this podcast.
And I may have butchered what he said. I feel like he said that, but I could have butchered it. So
no, I think you hit it pretty close, because there was concern of losing the badge over, you know, seeing a therapist was like a legitimate concern.
It's
and that's something that's been shared in the military too. A lot of people losing their identity because they went to mental health and they get shunned out, and it's changing. I think it's a little bit slower in the military still, but I know at work, it's at least on my shift, and that's who I spend over 90% of my year with. Honestly, it's not a taboo subject. When I was working the other day, due to some staffing, I ended up having someone driving me on our chase car, and we were talking about mental health on the way back from a call, and what he's doing, things I'm considering, you know, and it was a very open and frank discussion. He has made contact with another podcast. I don't know what his name is, but the page is Fuck the Stigma. And he went and just bought a bunch of stickers for everyone on the shift and said, hey, if you want one, here you go. And it's just an F the Stigma sticker and just getting it out there in the open. My captain has been very open about being there for us and understanding what's going on and how he has gone through his own things and how talking to someone and the being able to talk to his friends about it help as well. So. Yeah,
for all,
I think a big change is happening, at least in the fire service.
For all the ills of our former employer, I will always remember and appreciate, like, my very first pediatric arrest, once I, like, got done with turnover, go to check my phone, and my phone has blown up from people going, you okay? You okay? How was that? You okay? In communications that day, going, that was a good console. How are you holding up after that? And I was just like, oh, cool. Just in like the 5 years since I took my first EMT class, things have changed. Just like people really like EMS, like really looking out for each other and like making sure people are okay. And that's something I've always noticed and appreciated in the last couple of years, is when you hear somebody on the radio having like a bad call, you're just like, I'm going to make sure to text this person to make sure they're okay.
Here's what we have to do. We have to take care of our own because nobody else is going to, you know, it's our responsibility to be our brother and sister's keeper. It's vital. It's the only way we can stay strong and healthy.
Cody, you were going to say something, bud.
Yeah. It was something along the lines of like, your the statement that the gun and the badge and identity and those things being related, and you're like, you don't have to play hurt, you know? A lot of folks have not conceptualized, some of the things that get to us as actual injuries, just because you can't see it. You're not limping from it. It's not physical pain, and it's hard to describe emotional pain. Especially, just being the kind of men that we are, it's hard to describe, and I'm hurting emotionally and walk away from that conversation still feeling like I'm that guy. But there's, and I'm trying to remember who said it. There's a former state trooper, not a Maryland trooper. And I'm trying to remember who he is. He's the angry Viking therapist. Have you guys heard of this guy?
No.
My dudes, log on and check this guy out. He is the real deal. So he was a former law enforcement officer. And I think trooper, for whatever reason, that sticks out. and had a long career of just trauma, and it eventually, if I'm picking up what he's putting down correctly, it cost him his career, and his second career was to go and get a doctorate and become the remedy for other people to not have to go through that.
Trevor Wilkins.
Trevor Wilkins, yes, that's the guy. Very very interesting stuff, and you can hire him one-on-one, or you can participate in some of his groups that are all virtual and things like that. And he's a fantastic resource. I haven't used any of his stuff personally, but I've spoken with him, I've chatted with him on Instagram and things like that, because I really dig his content. But he speaks a lot to that. You know, you don't have to play hurt. You don't have to keep gutting through it, and you don't have to. But he's also very blunt, very real about why you may be acting the way that you're acting, and why it's not appropriate to do that. Your anger shouldn't overshadow Christmas dinner kind of stuff. So if you want that to stop happening, go get it fixed. Because, you know, kind of to your point, when we come back from that, so if you go out and you get seen, you talk it out and you get it handled, and then you come back and it's kind of like having a back injury, right? Like, oh, I'm going to be very careful about how I lift. I want to avoid these repeat instances. I don't want to tweak my back again, or I don't want to do the same thing that tore up my ankle. You know, the mental health, the mental injuries and the emotional injuries that we suffer, we tend to want to baby them the same way too. And so that, I think, is a little bit of where that identity crisis comes from, in that, oh man, I'm not, now that I've acknowledged this injury, I have this problem, and it's hard to get over that hump.
That's exactly when I got diagnosed with PTSD, how I felt. I have this problem. I have something wrong with me. I have an issue. And it took me years to move past that.
It's difficult. And part of it is society has, it became a societal issue, you know, back from Vietnam. And that's what people equate, you know, like PTSD stuff too, is military veterans that came back and they're all jacked up. And I, my fear in my soul is that same mentality is kind of permeated into our community,
mm-hmm.
and has been for years. And you're just this unstable person that's walking around, you know, just gonna explode one day and just gonna flip out. And, yep. You know,
that's just,
I don't know. I don't know what the fix is for it.
I think the fix is already happening. You know, we're talking about it. You know, I think that's step one. And the fact that everybody here has talked about the open and frank discussions they've had at work about this type of thing, I think that is the fix. I don't think there's any other fix. I think when you have somebody who brings in the green bumper stickers that say F the stigma, that's part of the fix, that we can mm-hmm. put that on our cars. We can talk about it, that we can address these issues like mature adults and not be afraid to have the conversation and not feel like less of a person because we have a mental health issue, and we can treat each other as equals and we can move forward.
They tie it back into like the whole safety thing too. Like, I know on our checklist, like I just checked just now just to confirm, but like actually the last point on there is, do you have any life stressors that are going on right now that might affect work? If yes, like just go ahead and call your manager or the manager on call and talk it out with them and see what needs to be done, as like the ultimate safety point of like, no, like we don't, it's the holistic thing of like, it's not safe. If you're not safe, that means nobody's safe.
Yeah, that's fair.
Wow, man, that's huge.
Yeah, I was going to say that if you're not safe, no one's safe. That is huge. That sounds like a solid Instagram reel, not going to lie.
It sounds like a good episode title.
TM, TM.
Yeah.
I'm going to start making bumper stickers of that.
I like that. You should. I mean, buy one.
Yeah, but it's especially true, because then if you're not safe, you're not making good patient decisions, and especially flight, you're not making good safety decision, because if you're distracted, you're not going to be like where everybody is expected to like do the walk around. Just like if you're going to miss something like a bolt that's out of place, which then other people might miss too. So you are losing that overlapping system. You're not going to secure the thing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you think that we, with that mentality though, we might miss the folks that are like really good at compartmentalizing? Like the bells go off, the tones go off, I'm locked in because that's where I feel like I'm on my game or whatever. So I'm locked in, tones go off. I'm good. I'm good as long as I'm doing the job because I'm distracted, right? Mm-hmm. And in between calls.
I think it will manifest in other ways that will like get caught in other fashion. Like kind of like what you said where as an NCO, and I remember hearing something like this too, that you've relayed, like, problems always related to, you know, like one of four things: finances, family, fucking around, you know, stuff like that. Things always end up coming out in the wash eventually. Like, so, okay, yeah, you can compartmentalize, but when you compartmentalize, maybe you start making some decisions in your care that are a little questionable to your coworkers, or like come up in QA, like, why did they decide not to do this? Or maybe they went too far and it's like, maybe that was a little aggressive. Yep. And now let's have a talk.
They're more conservative where they wouldn't have been, or they're criking people that didn't need it.
Yeah. And you know, like I know, and I've brought it up here. I know our QA process in my agency is like a holistic look. When you come in for like an MRC and they really want to like, okay, what do we need to do to make sure that you're not doing these things? Like, okay, you've had complaints about having an attitude problem with patients, patients' families, or hospital staff or something, and it's just this mounting thing. What's going on? Like, what's making this happen? Like, your care is fine, but you cannot talk to people right now, and you just get angry or whatever it is. I'd say there's a strong chance that something else is going on outside of work or outside of the scene and patient care that we're doing, that's going to be like, okay, things aren't safe. Yeah. Is it as direct? Unfortunately not. Sometimes it takes time to come out in the wash, and that can still introduce that period of unsafe environments. So
I think to Cody's point, though, the reality of people who have long-term mental health issues or mental illness is that they are really good at hiding it sometimes. They're really good at suppressing it in front of other people. And you would never know how depressed they are. You would never know that they're having SI. You would never know that, you know, they're having these sorts of issues. And then eventually it does all fall out. But usually when it all falls out, it's very dramatic. And they're a risk to themselves. They may make questionable decisions, and you know, if they're working in healthcare, that put other people at risk. And we need to find ways to identify that before it gets to that point. And I think the only way to do that is, like I said before, to have these conversations and make it okay to talk about, and make it okay not to be okay, because they're going to lie. You know, you can lie on a questionnaire. I would have lied on questionnaires many times. I just think that we need to encourage these open discussions.
I mean, there's the Alaska Air pilot a month or two ago who riding in the jump seat, who has had a terrible 2 months and had, because of FAA regulations of, well, you can't take most antidepressants, and if you talk to a therapist, you might lose your flight status, had a break and tried to crash a plane.
Yeah. I didn't know those were actual FAA regulations. That's horrifying.
Until the last couple of years, like, it's, Cody, what is it? It's not SSRIs you can't take. It's something else.
Well, there's actually a publicly available list of medication types and you know, let's say, for instance, and to get away from psychotropics, but, you know, if you have a cold, and there are medications like Sudafed that have the ephedrine or dextromethorphan, and you take that, they have them on this list because there's a chance that they can make you drowsy, like known side effect is being drowsy. And so it's usually something like like times 4 hours from the dose, from the last dose that you took it. So something like that, man. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Like, well, the FAA is like, does not really necessarily encourage good mental health, because they will strip people of their flight status. It's a lot, especially within the helicopter industry. A lot of pilots got their like helicopter training in the military, and so most if not all of them have some form of PTSD, which then they have to, a lot of them have to kind of tiptoe around that, like treatment for that, because they're worried about the FAA yanking their flight status. Yeah. Because of
is
like,
is there an FAA specific physical that's like kind of like yes. a DOT physical? Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to drop this
class 3 flight physical.
I'm going to drop this in the chat. I found the link of the meds you can't take and fly. Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
It's a pretty exhaustive list, and you know, just to take, you know, you're taking something like a Sudafed so you can feel better, so that you can go to work, but you can't go to work because you try to do something to make yourself feel better, you know, so that you could perform the job. You know, it sucks. Although yeah. I understand why it's there, and I certainly see the utility of it.
Yeah, basically, if you take any psych meds, you cannot fly. I mean, it's pretty comprehensive.
Like, I knew of like a friend of a friend who like really wanted to just fly little like puddle jumper Cessnas just recreationally, but he's like, yeah, it means I would have to stop taking my antidepressants, and I don't want to do that, which would get him on a big tangent of, you know, they want to promote safety, but they would rather somebody be like hiding their issues and not get treated and be like, yes, you can be behind the wheel of this of an aircraft.
Holy shit, controlled substances scheduled 1 through 4, just a blanket no.
Yep.
Yep.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
And that's gonna be like any kind of pilot.
Yes.
Damn.
No, the FAA physical is crazy.
Me neither. I strike out many times on this list.
And to be clear, I don't know what I don't know. I'm not criticizing this. I just I don't know. Side note, aren't like air traffic controllers, like, don't they have some of the worst mental health things too? Is that, why am I thinking that? Is that true? Do you guys know that? I feel like that's the thing.
I've heard that anecdotally, and I know there's that movie that kind of plays up to that.
And I wonder if they have similar restrictions. I don't know. I imagine that's a pretty stressful job. And
I know they have work hour restrictions and mandated retirement ages.
You know why it's so stressful, though, right? Because they all see UFOs and they can't report them, and they have to hire.
Oh, geez. I knew that was something like that was coming.
Well, now they can report them.
But you know, for many years they couldn't.
It's now a centralized repository, so the people in the black suits just show up and know where to go. It's just one place they have to check instead of all the interwebs.
That's right.
Oh,
apparently that place is Ken's house.
That's right. They come by every night in the middle of the night, knock on my door.
Why does Ken have 10 black Suburbans at his house every night?
Whenever we fly at night, I always feel like I'm Ken, just because we're always going, shouldn't there be UFOs out in the Pacific Northwest at night?
They're all busy being off the coast of San Diego.
Apparently. I've seen no Bigfoots. I've seen no UFOs. I'm feeling deprived. I'm feeling like I'm not getting what was advertised moving out here.
Hey, not to change the subject, I do have a question. And more so, I think I know the answer already, but I called Cody because I was working and I sort of needed emergently the answer to this question. What's the maximum distance that a helicopter generally can fly? And like, where does like fixed wing make up that distance? Does that question make sense?
Yes.
And the reason I'm asking you this is because I called Cody and I was like, hey, can a helicopter fly this many hours? And he's like, no. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. I didn't know. But yeah, good.
To be real pedantic about it, it becomes like, depends on the airframe. But so like the one, Cody, I don't remember what are the ranges on the 135, just because I'm new to the 135. But generally speaking, it's a helicopter has about 2 hours or so of flight time before they need to refuel. Like, they generally have like 2.5 hours of fuel, and they're not supposed to tap into that last half hour. And
yep, generally, yeah.
And so it depends on the airframe. Like, for example, like the one, like the 119 flies about like 100, cruising speed is roughly at like 120 knots. So they can go about 240 nautical miles. Like the Bell 407 goes about 100 knots, so about 200. But for like around here, for example, so you can fly from, say, like the close to the border of Eastern Washington or Oregon, and get to Seattle or Portland.
Which that is good to know.
Of course, if you got a burly crew, that always affects it. Or if your patient's particularly burly, that also can limit your rotor wing
also radius. And depends on how like the air temperature, just because you're going to be burning a lot more fuel when it's hot outside, just because there's a lot harder to get bite onto the air to take off. But so generally speaking, if the flight's going to be more than like 2 hours, you're going to try to fixed wing them.
So since we kind of switched topics off of mental health, safety, and back into flight medicine, Owen, what made you want to leave the East Coast and leave ground 911? And go critical care and go all the way over to the other side of the country and do that job? What was the catalyst for, you know, because I'm sure there's someone that's listening that is thinking about a career change, a job change, an elevation in care, credentialing. What made you make that decision?
Just kind of like, I guess, feeling a little bit more to like being able to like perform more up to what I thought my abilities and standards were, and being able to like really test myself, just because I know like in like an urban setting, you're going to have a lot of like just kind of like nonsense calls and it's just kind of wears on you a little bit more, and not being able to really do the things you could or should be doing. And but like out here, it's literally like kind of the Wild West, where I'm going into like hospitals or going into scenes, and I have literally been greeted with, "Oh, thank God the flight crew's here." Like I will go into like these little tertiary facilities that are like on the side of a mountain, where there's one where we went in and the ER doc was done for the day, and she's like, "Okay, I'll see you guys tomorrow. I'm the internist tomorrow." Where there's three doctors in the whole thing. We're talking like the entire ER is the size of like a standard ambulance bay. Like, and it's like, "Oh, hey, you're in charge now. This is your patient. Yep. Please,
four-wall scene call, man.
Please save us."
Four-wall scene call.
Yeah.
Mm.
And just being able to kind of like really kind of like practice like the kind of like the peak levels of like emergency medicine, like in a pre-hospital, like as a paramedic, is one of those things that really like called to me. And okay, it's super fun, and plus I get paid to fly on a helicopter.
And did you do like a critical care class before making that jump? Did you do it during it?
Yeah. Like when I left the urban department I was at with Ken, I went to work for a critical care transport company to get essentially the experience I need to make the jump from like ground 911 to doing ground critical care and flight. So they let me like pick people's brains for starting from my FPC test. It let me get experience working with all the equipment. It let me really get experience with dealing with like the vents and like the various like medication drips and stuff like that.
And you were saying before we started too that you've got a pretty liberal scope of practice, right? Like your medical director allows you a lot of leeway.
Oh yeah. He is, our medical director is very much the do what is in the best interest of the patient. And it's very much we have a pretty voluminous like guideline protocol. And he's very much the, "Hey, these are just guidelines. Do what you need to do. I am always available for you to like call if you're stumped or if you're having issues. He's like, but we hired you because we don't hire people because they're pretty. We hire people because they're smart. Which, if you look at some of my coworkers, is very true, myself included. It's we want people who are able to think independently.
Now, when you got hired there, you had to get credentialed in multiple states, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
For better or for worse, one of the things, fun things about EMS and nursing, because it is not like overseen by a national agency, like I'm sure you would love it to be overseen by, it's every state has its own individual requirements. So for example, the state of Oregon's is like, hey, how long you been a medic? 5 years? Cool. Write us a check. Thanks. For the state of Washington and the state of Idaho, they're like, oh, cool. Retake the national written. Pass it. Thanks.
New Mexico was kind of gnarly like that. You had to take a New Mexico level protocol test, which is essentially another written national registry test to get New Mexico credentials.
Hmm. Remember when we used to have to do that in Maryland?
Oh, do you not have to do that anymore?
No. With COVID started, that you don't have to take a protocol test. You finish your national, you get everything. You then take a online class through the online training center for MIMS. You finish the PowerPoint and you get your conditional card until the one shows up in the mail.
This makes me feel like a fucking grumpy old man. I had to take the psychomotor for my national. I had to take a protocol from Maryland.
I had to take the Maryland EMTB protocol test when I came back with my EMT from Virginia. The Maryland paramedic protocol test when I came back from Texas with my medic. Oh, I feel old. I had to tell a student, like, oh, this is what you're going to do. This is what you're going to do. Da, 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 da. And then she came to me a week later, like, it was nothing like that. I was like, what?
So it's funny you guys say this because I didn't learn any of this until like a couple weeks ago. I was like, wait, there's no protocol test anymore? And they're like, nope. And apparently there is. I shouldn't mention that. I don't know. Somewhere I heard that there's like an online test now, like after what you're describing, but I don't know what the official, I should know, I guess, but I don't. But yeah, no, even, I mean, I haven't been, I got my paramedic in what, 2017, and I still had to do a protocol test and everything. So it's a very recent change. Yeah.
Oh, the new national written is weird as shit, by the way, because it's no longer just like, okay, which of these is the most right? Now they have like extended like scenarios. They have like rank choices stuff. Like I remember on like there was like a like 10 questions on mine that's just like, okay, here's the scenario. You're driving to a call that has where someone has asthma. Now rank, put in order, what are your going to be your foremost priorities? And the next question is like a continuation of that, and it's just like what, choose the answer you think is best, and then it's based on that, what are you going to do next? And so, like, at least for that, now it lets you actually go back and look at, see what the fuck is going on. But it is very weird now.
Hey, I'd heard about that. I think they tested out a little bit last year with students testing last year, but now it is the standard for the national written. But yeah. I know in Texas, you know, when it comes to getting a card, you simply submit your national card and they say, oh, here's your card. No affiliation, no nothing. I think I paid $25.
Delegated practice.
Oregon's is kind of weird because to get reciprocity in the state of Oregon, you either have to have like an associate's degree, literally in anything. In addition, it can be in basket weaving, in addition to your paramedic.
Type of degree, yeah.
Or you have to have your paramedic and 3 of the last 5 years have to be active as a paramedic. They're like, okay, you filled, check those boxes, cool. Give us a $300 check and here's your card. State of what? Yeah. It's just no real like rhyme or reason to how any of these states do their reciprocity.
I mean, not that you work in California, but California, they do it by like by agency, by county, give you your card. It's not you don't get a state license.
New York is that way.
Like Orange County gives you a license, but you can't go to, I don't know, if Riverside County is a county, I can't think of it is or not. Or Sacramento, which you just go up to Sacramento, you move up there, you have to get a whole new, you have to take another test.
Oh, wow.
In that county.
Someone was telling me, like, they can get really petty in California, too. Like, if you're in, like, licensed in, like, Sacramento County and you go to Fresno County or whatever, like, next door, and if you do something that's technically not in the Fresno scope, they'll narc on you, is what they were saying.
Wow. Even if it's legal in the other jurisdiction.
Or it was something like that where someone was telling me, like, it was a nurse who also has their, who was doing critical care down there. And, like, the paramedic said, hey, you have to push the paralytic because I can't do it in this county.
I mean, to be fair, we sort of have that going on in Maryland where people say, oh, I'm not a paramedic in this county. And because of that, I can't do X, Y, or Z, even though I have a paramedic license in my pocket. Yeah, so
I understand what you're saying there. Yeah, yeah. Credentialing underneath a medical director. Yes, I can kind of understand that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just,
but
I feel like it's weird.
In the same vein, if I'm on a unit that is the county that I am credentialed under, and I go into another county, I can't be like, oh, well, you know, I can't work in this county because I'm credentialed in that one, not this one that I'm in right now.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it says on the unit where I'm coming from and who's transporting. I think that's what kind of happens a little bit in other states when you cross county lines.
So. Yeah.
I know Virginia's kind of weird about that, where just like every county has its own medical director, and you have some places like Fairfax City that have like iStats, and then you have like places like Prince William County, who are just like, I don't know, we have a glucometer.
Yeah, right now I just learned the other day that so across the river they have the Factor program, which is a whole blood program that Loudoun uses, Fairfax City uses, Alexandria uses, but Fairfax County doesn't.
I thought Fairfax was trying to put, just like Baltimore City was trying to put it on, like, officer buggies.
According to one of my chiefs, they are far from that in Fairfax right now.
Hmm.
So,
blood product is great. I love carrying whole blood. Blood products.
I mean,
yes.
If you guys can do everything, you might as well be carrying whole blood, right?
It's actually kind of funny because there's like a couple things that, like, couple toys that we don't carry, but if we don't carry something, it has usually been the discussion of, like, apparently, like, ad nauseum. Like, we don't carry, like, any point-of-care ultrasound, and if you ask certain people in it, they're like, I swear to God, we have had so many goddamn conversations about this. What it ultimately comes down to is, like, from my understanding is, they don't think it's worth carrying the extra weight and the extra space because they're like, what are you going to fucking use it for? You're going to use it for a couple things, or the best, everything's going to look like a nail with this hammer, and it's not necessarily going to super change what you were going to do anyway, especially because, oh, they have blood. If you hear blood in their chest, congratulations, you were going to either do a finger thor or a chest dart on them anyway. You can do a chest tube, which you were going to do anyway.
And hopefully you didn't need the ultrasound to tell you to do it.
Exactly. That's exactly what their thought is. They're just like, yo, you should be making clinical decisions based on all the other presentation. You shouldn't be like, hold on, this person got hit by a truck. Hold on, let me do an EFAST assessment on them real quick instead of putting a chest tube in them on scene.
That sums that up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That is interesting. Yeah, I mean we had this conversation yesterday, so I guess for the listeners, they'll be listening to to Mike's episode a week before this, and it's almost like we had the exact same statements made. It's interesting.
You know, when you asked that question, I knew what he was going to say, Musa. You know, I follow him on Instagram, and I know how Mike feels about POCUS, and it was quite funny, and he did not hold back, and him and Owen. And Owen's coworkers have the same thoughts.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And it's shared by a lot of people too.
It's a cool tool that is just like, cool. That's thumbs up. Just like, if would probably better in an ER to get a deep vein, but in terms of an EFAST like thing, I'm just like, I don't care.
But you can measure intraocular pressures with it.
Thank God.
Not this changing.
Here, let's get some gel in your eye.
Hey, Owen, I just want to make sure, were there any topics that you wanted to talk about that we didn't mention yet?
That's pretty much it. Just maybe want to touch on like the interestingness of like, I know Cody experiences this, of going to like certain facilities and like how different it is to interact with different levels of providers nowadays.
Yeah, man. I mean, you probably have this experience out there of now you walk into an ED, and I'm not disparaging the nursing staff in any way, shape, or form, but you're getting a nurse who was in nursing school or did a big piece of their nursing school and internships during COVID, which I think we can all agree was not the most robust clinical training that they could have gotten during that time period, because we were trying to like get them through. And, you know, you're used to getting a certain level of report and a certain level of support from these folks. And man, that, I don't want to say it's non-existent, but it has certainly changed a little bit to where when we walk into these facilities now, we feel a little bit more like we're on our own.
Oh yeah.
What do you think, Owen?
Yeah, I think like, especially out here, it can like swing both ways. Cause like I'll walk into like the mountainside place that with three beds. And if they have any kind of like high acuity stuff, they are so not used to dealing with stuff like that. They're just kind of, I don't want to say panicking, but they're just trying to do what they can to keep them stable until we can get there. Just because I know, like, my company very much referring to, like, our helicopters as mobile critical care units. And also, just on the same side with, like, scene calls, I've been on some where it's just like, oh, you did most of my work for me. Where it's somebody, like, yeah, like, one where, like, we got called for some 17-year-old who was had been in like status epilepticus in like an onion field for like 45 minutes. We get there, like they already have him, they're like bagging him, they have him hooked up to capno, they've already like broken his seizures, and they're like, yeah, we figured that since you guys have more experience with RSI, that's something you'd want to do. I'm like, cool, don't mind if I do. And I've had like, yeah. And I've had ERs say that the same thing. Like they're like, they don't feel comfortable like doing certain procedures, or they don't want to like ask permission from the receiving facility. So they're just like, we think you should do this, but it's ultimately you're going to be with them in this helicopter for the next hour. And so if you think you should RSI this person or start these drips, cool, go for it.
Yeah. Mike had a recent podcast, the one he slightly referenced last night about the call that made him throw up. He talked, the main focus of it was the too sick to transfer line. Critical care. And I know this could probably branch into a whole nother episode for Cody and Owen right now, but he talked about the same thing where like the flight crew comes in. And the hospital's like, oh, great, they're here. They can do all these things that they're not comfortable doing, because it's something that in the flight realm, and once again, another topic that can be talked about is how the flight realm has a higher level of training, higher level of standards, typically, like where you guys have to do some pretty in-depth skills validation throughout the year, CE, stuff like that, where you're coming in and you guys might end up doing more chest tubes or, you know, high level pressure drips, high level drips, RSIs than the hospitals that you're going into. Like they, and so,
oh yeah,
he talks about it, you know, briefly, and it's a very good talk, and it's, you know, I wouldn't just touch on it. That's what happens. I mean, I don't work critical care. You guys do, but
yeah,
you know.
It's definitely not like, it's definitely not like saying they're poor providers, like, because again, these are like just rural like very rural hospitals that, and even calling them a hospital is like not necessarily accurate. It's often literally just like essentially an urgent care that has like two beds that can keep people overnight. And it's not that they're bad providers; it's just they don't have the reps.
Yeah, man.
If anything, I'd call them good providers because they know their limits.
Yeah, and they are able to use their resources by calling flight, but going, cool, this guy's fucked. Well, so we need to get him out of here.
There's a reason why that all that training happens, and it's not because you're an aircraft, you have to know these things. Is that when those little facilities like that, they call you, and to you guys' credit for pointing out that they're not bad providers and they're not inept. They just lack the capability to do what they need to do for that person. And here's the cool thing about what we do, Owen, and I would challenge the rest of the folks no matter what level you're operating at, to adopt a similar mentality. So I'm stealing this from I think it was a Boston MedFlight video, so props to them. But there's an expectation that when an air medical crew or a critical care transport crew shows up to a facility like that, the expectation is that you are now the most capable clinician in the building, right? You're not the highest certified, you're not a physician, but you are the most capable because that's what you do day in and day out. You take sick person who's beyond the capacity or the capability of the institution, the facility that they're at, and you have to keep them alive at the same level of care or higher throughout the rest of that transport. And there's a certain pressure that comes with that. And that's why organizations like mine and Owen's and we train to that level, is because that is the baseline expectation. And there's a certain, some folks think it's a big pat on the back, but there's a certain level of pressure that comes when you walk in and there's an ED physician who's been with this patient for maybe four hours, maybe 30 minutes, and says, hey man, you just do what you think you need to do. And you're like, shit, really? I mean, it's your show. So you know, initially you try to defer and go, hey man, this is your show. We're here to help you out. And he's like, that's great. You'd be helping me out by doing whatever you need to do to get out of here. And that's literally sometimes it's not the handoff report, but that is the overarching verbal order, is do what you need to do to keep this guy alive until they get to X facility.
Yeah. Going back, like, thank God flight is here is both simultaneously the most confidence inspiring and most terrifying thing you will ever hear.
Bad. That's how you know it's bad. You're like, oh, I don't want to go in there. I do not want to go in there.
You're just where's my narc pouch?
Yeah.
You instantly know you're going to be like, oh, I got all six of my pumps, right? I'm going to use all of them. I can already feel it.
We should do an episode on this, because this is interesting. Because I mean, I have a lot of questions, but we have been going for, and I have so many questions. Because I did this, I did interfacility, like critical care stuff, for a very short while. And the few calls that I remember when we showed up, I'll tell you after we stop recording, but it was an eye opening experience, to say the least.
But I mean, yeah, again, to touch back with what Josh was saying, like, this type of stuff is like what made me want to do it. And I'm sure made Cody want to do it too, is just being able to be like the best provider you can be in these type of situations.
I totally did it for the ego stuff. Totally.
It's always like, I was telling Ken, like, it's an incredibly feeling just to be like, I'm one of the worst providers in my company, and I am a very goddamn good provider at the same time. Just like working with people who are so good.
And Owen, that's a great thing that I love that you say that, because our environment, and you know, you're on a top tier team when you feel like, I am having to work 1,000 times harder than I ever have just to be mediocre here.
Yeah.
And what we're finding out as we bring on, as I talk to more new flight providers and I bring more on into the organization, I find out that it's like, hey man, you know what? You were really smart and you were really popular where you were. There's a different story here. You know, it's not like a small fish in a big pond mm-hmm. kind of thing. And it's not an egotistical thing, and it's not a to knock somebody down thing, but it's like, man, you don't know how hard you're going to have to work to just be mediocre here.
Yeah.
And that's an awesome, I love that pressure.
Yeah.
I remember you know, granted, like I said, I don't work in critical care. Who knows in the future?
I recommend it.
We're hiring.
I felt that exact way when I was sitting in critical care class. Like, I like to think I know what I'm doing. I've been doing this for a little while. I think I do a pretty good job at it. But I sat there in class and I was like, I am challenged in this environment. It was just class. You're like, this is a lot of information. This is like, I thought I was top tier. I'm like, oh my God, there's so much I need to learn new or relearn and to be even passing this course.
It's fun.
Not like excelling at it, passing it. That's it.
It's funny you say that because my old partner and I'm going to give a shout out to my partner, Joey B, if he's listening out there. Owen might know him. We took a FPC review class just for fun when there was an EMS convention in town. And we're like, you know, maybe if this isn't so bad, maybe we'll go take flight paramedic together. And it was so over our heads. And we always considered ourselves to be pretty good paramedics. And we may just be mediocrity in a sea of not so mediocrity. But...
Well, to be clear, it's different. But yeah, finish your sentence. But yeah.
But it was just so over our heads. And we were just like, this stuff is wild. Like, we're talking about, you know, pressures and pumps and balloon pumps and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And we're like, it would probably be different if we took an actual class and started from square one as opposed to a review class. But at the same time, just the things we didn't know walking in that door, we were like, this is amazing.
It really is kind of just like when you had your first EMT class and your first paramedic class and you get all your books, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But it's very much the, okay, small bites type of thing. But also, I hate balloon pumps, for the record.
Well, there's something I want for the listeners, and to some degree for you guys to hear too, that, you know, critical care is, and I'm totally robbing an unnamed author, and I cannot remember his freaking name to save my life or who said it or where I read it from, but critical care is not a location and it's not a particular kind of vehicle. It's a concept. It's a mindset that you can adopt. And so I don't care if you're an engine crew, you know, paramedic that's not riding the box anymore, but I encourage all of you to go to a course, a real course, not, don't do a 16 hour test prep course that does nothing for you except get you ready for the test. Go to an actual factual course and just get that depth to your thought processes and go back out on the street and just see how much, one, in my opinion, how much easier your life is because you're thinking through different, you're thinking about your decisions differently. You almost start to, I hate to say this because I know who some of the audience is, but you kind of outgrow your protocol a little bit. So you get out of cookbook medicine thinking and you start thinking about 911 medicine or emergency medicine, what we do at our level anyway, conceptually and going, do I really need to do that for this person? Or I need to escalate this way beyond what may be allowable in my protocol.
Yeah.
But I have the tool to do it.
I agree with that 100%. I came away from the course. There's stuff that I'll never use in 911 from the course, obviously. Balloon pumps, never going to see. You know, whole variety of things. But it opened up my mind to not only what else I could be doing, thinking outside of the protocols, but also, what is this patient's course of treatment past me going to be? Like, what is the hospital look at this with this patient?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, obviously it's not a medical education. I'm not coming away with, you know, doctor level knowledge, but it's something to make you think like, okay, I can do these things to make this stuff easier at the hospital.
Yeah.
Like, let me prep this patient properly for the environment they're going into to make their life a little bit easier on the other end to produce better patient outcomes.
Do you guys think that... Go ahead, man. Go ahead.
No, that was really what I was going to say. Go ahead.
Do you guys think that the general practice paramedic in 2023 sees their job more as get them from the house or from the street to the hospital instead of seeing themselves as a part of the patient care process, where there's things that I should have done before this patient gets to the ED or like sometimes for us with the CCRU, right? There's things that should be in place so that they can pick up the ball from there and then keep moving it forward. It embarrasses the hell out of me if I think for a second that the receiving team has to go back and do things that I should have done or should have had done.
So
you know, before they can move on with what they need to do, it delays the definitive care.
I think my answer, that comes down to like individual people, just because I know like I've heard some people, as I've told Ken, like a lot of like in some places I kind of categorize medics in one of three categories. One, like, diesel therapy is the only therapy I care about. Two is people who like, no, let me actually try to, you know, get this ball rolling. And three, people who are just like kind of clueless. Just because, but I've known a lot of people who are just like, I mean, I could, you know, start them on like a mag drip or a ketamine drip because of like their respiratory issues. Or I could just, you know, let the hospital deal with it.
To make it their problem.
Yeah, I think that it does definitely, it varies from individual to individual. I think we are going to start seeing a paradigm shift back to the, what can I do in route to the hospital? Like, I should be doing these things. I think we were stuck in a realm of do minimal, get them to the hospital. The hospital is going to do everything else. What I'm about to say, I said on my first podcast here as a guest. And that is that for years, paramedic courses and EMT courses had this you either were stay and play or load and go. And we always taught that the sickest patients in class were load and go. And whether you want to argue that someone consciously thinks that, oh, this patient's a load and go because that's what I learned in class or not, that is somewhere in their mind that better things can be done at the hospital. But the things that we have seen, the advances in not only knowledge, but skills in the past, I'm just going to say 5 years, because I think there's been a huge jump in 5 years, is going to start translating into the new paramedics. And the people that are on, I'd say the first half of their career are going to start changing their practice as they start being able to implement these things and realize, oh, there's a lot that I can do before I get to the hospital. I think in another episode I said, if you look at EMS overall across the nation, I think the only things that EMS can't do that would be done in the hospital is a CT scan, an X-ray, and maybe certain medication administrations. But if you look at EMS as a whole, I'm not talking about a single agency, there's agencies that are doing sutures in the field. There are agencies that are prescribing medications in the field. There are agencies that are doing POCUS. There are agencies that are giving high-level pressors. There's drips. There are agencies that are seeing patients in their house and discharging them to go see someone else, writing them a note. Yes. Is there an advanced practice provider involved with that? Yeah, but it's still part of the EMS delivery. So there's like, we're starting to bridge that gap between a lot of the things that we can do here and a lot of things that can be done in the ER. ICU, different story. That's extended care. They're going to be able to do some other things that we can't, obviously. I don't think we'll ever see ECMO in the back of an ambulance.
Don't tell our Ken and I's friend that.
As we're getting these things and as they make their way into more agencies, I think you're going to see a lot of people start to be able to do a lot more between the house and the hospital and the ideology behind it.
I think you're right. And I think like, since we've all been in Maryland, I think Maryland actually codifying the, hey, if you have a sick patient, start going through those protocols.
Yep.
That's why they're there. Do those instead of just going, nah, let's make it a hospital problem. Was an enlightened idea.
I agree. And I think it's a little bit generational too. I think newer providers or clinicians are being taught to stay in play in situations where we used to teach load and go, but there's still a very strong mentality out there amongst people who've been doing this for a long time that load and go is the answer because that's what was drilled into them, and the protocol can change, but they don't think that's important. They think that's ridiculous. They think it's out of touch. I've had people tell me that, and I've tried to argue with them, and it's like they don't, some people don't understand how medicine is changing, and it's very hard to beat, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years of being ingrained load and go with a piece of paper that says otherwise.
Going back into the what made me want to do, like, good critical care and touching on what Cody said, for me, it's also like kind of like an ego thing where it's just like, no, I spent all this time getting my my paramedic card. I'm going to use these medications. I'm going to do something with it. I'm not going to like let the hospital just like, no, I studied way too much to not have to not, you know how to use these and then use all these like tools in my truck.
And certainly it's getting to the point where some hospitals I've seen will ask EMS, why didn't you do XYZ appropriate treatment? Right. And I've certainly seen it. Luckily not with me, as the provider, but with other providers, they say, why didn't you put this patient on CPAP and run NIBs through it? Or why didn't you run your mag? Why didn't you call us for a mag drip? Actually, that's not true. I have been dinged for, this was early in my career, for a hypotensive patient who was tachypnic and diaphoretic, and he was having respiratory distress, and I didn't drop the needle. I made the mistake, and I even consulted, and when I got to the hospital, the doc was like, why didn't you ask me for a needle? I would have given it to you. And I was like, I'm not sure. And now the guy ended up having like a massive like diaphragm rupture too. So, I mean, ooh, that it wasn't a 10. So I was correct in knowing that it wasn't a lung expansion problem. My explanation was I could hear lung sounds, so I didn't feel like it was the appropriate treatment. But yeah, I mean, that is one of those things where I was legit asked, hey, why didn't you do that treatment? So I think that's, I don't know if it's more of an occurrence now, but I've certainly seen it where hospitals will definitely ding you, especially if they know your protocol. Why didn't you do the appropriate care that you're supposed to do?
I saw it the other day, actually. I had just had a simple trip and fall that broke their wrist. I gave fentanyl, Toradol, Zofran, and then redosed fentanyl as we showed up at the hospital. And when I did my handoff with the nurse, she was like, you did all that? She's like, wow, you hit all the boxes. And in my mind, I'm like, oh man, that means people aren't doing their job.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny you said that, because I was just about to say that in response to what Moose said, was that, man, that was a treatment decision that you made based on your assessment and your gestalt. And there's a difference between that and making I guess, what would that be called? That'd be called a diagnostic error. That's different from being a lazy ass. Mm-hmm. And going, you know what? Scoop them up. Let's go. Diesel. Just giving them diesel. There's two completely different things, man.
I was just using that as the closest example I could think of when I was asked why I didn't do something. But yeah, no, I get what you're coming from. Yeah.
You don't belong in the box with the lazy ones.
Sorry, we can't all be perfect like you, Moose.
No. Oh, God. Jesus. I'm a desk paramedic, buddy.
Me too, no.
You a suit and tie medic now.
Yeah, Ken, you are the suit. I don't necessarily have to wear a suit. You gotta wear a shirt and tie.
Yeah, I do.
Ooh.
For real?
Yeah.
They make you wear a suit and a tie?
I love my ties.
Or they make you wear a tie?
I love my ties.
You got cool ties though. You got like Star Wars ties, you got UFO ties.
Yeah, I do.
I got boring.
I haven't worn any of the exciting ones yet. I'm trying to make it through my first. Maybe Friday. They say Friday you can dress down. So I thought maybe Friday I'll wear my UFO tie, my Sasquatch tie.
He's trying to trick them into thinking he's a normie.
Yeah, I'm trying. My boss scares me.
Man. We're at an hour and 40 minutes almost.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm going to wrap this up.
Yeah. Owen, you got any last minute comments, buddy?
No, I'd be happy to come back and do the Moose asks everything he wants to know about flight medicine, though.
Yeah, yeah, no. Oh, trust me, the amount of times I call Cody on certain days, oh, man. He's kind of like my relief valve for when I have flight questions in like an emergent setting. So, hey guys, you guys have any closing comments?
No, it was a great time. Thanks for coming on.
That flew by.
Learned vent theory. Someone's going to fight me outside for that one, but vent theory is like really, really helpful for learning all kinds of respiratory processes. And I know there's a million times people are taking somebody from a vent farm because they have the sniffles, or you're like, oh, they H&H is low. And so people then actually can make it worse in the 5 minutes they're transporting somebody when they're not on a vent. And so that would be, if someone's going to learn any kind of critical care stuff, vent theory is pretty high on there, even though it is kind of dense.
Yeah.
I would love to do like a true respiratory physiology review, because you start throwing in like stuff like fixed law and all these laws, people are just like, and even when I talk about it on here, people, my co-hosts make fun of me sometimes, but it's fine. I think it'll be a really cool topic to do. You guys should fight out who's going to close out the show.
I vote Cody.
I don't know how. What am I supposed to say?
You better figure it out. You're on. This is it.
I got put on the spot my first time, so have fun.
For the
listeners not watching, he just took a sip of his whiskey.
Water.
I don't think that was necessarily a sip.
Water. So, hey, all the listeners out there, we appreciate you guys listening. You can find us on all of the major social media platforms. And we will be publishing next week. We appreciate everybody listening. Have a good day. Bye-bye now. What the fuck am I supposed to say? That's terrible. That was so shitty.